I think we're going to move from themes from this morning, which had a lot to do with organization of systems inside the cell that support development, to systems outside the cell, and systems that allow tissues to interact during development. Now, Arturo Cano is at the IRCM. He's our next speaker. He's going to talk to us about the brain and circuitry in the brain, so a very complex extracellular level of organization. Arturo was an undergraduate here. He actually went to Marianopolis and then McGill. He slipped across the border and went to Baylor, where he began working on the genes that regulate peripheral nerve development in Drosophila. And then he took a postdoc in Columbia in New York City and discovered some of the key genes that regulate motor neuron axon migration, all having to do with connections that are to be made, and then was recruited to the IRCM, where he's continued this work, and I think it was 2004, if I'm not mistaken. So with no further ado, let's hear some more about the circuitry in the brain and its development. Arturo Cano.
Thank you very much for that very nice introduction. It's a pleasure to be here. It's also a pleasure to learn that I am one of the world-renowned experts in neural development, as I found out from the poster. So my lab is interested in development of organization in the nervous system. So I want to use this first slide to illustrate what do I mean by organization, and more specifically, topography. So this is an illustration from a famous study published by Dr. Penfield, actually, after whom that avenue up there was named. So what Penfield did was he was actually doing something very interesting, and I guess something that cannot be done anymore or very easily done, which is to stick electrodes in people's brains and stimulate different areas of the brain to find out what these areas represent, so which areas of the body are represented in those regions. So, for example, there is a sensory region on the brain which receives sensory information, but there's also a motor area in the cortex which is commanding the movement of different muscles in our body. And so what this illustration shows was actually the organization of the different neurons in the different areas of the cortex that control different parts of the body. And what you can see here is that neurons that control adjacent parts of the body are located in adjacent regions of the cortex. So, for example, neurons that control the movement of the wrist lie next to neurons that control movements of the hand. And so, by consequence, if you think about this, these neurons have descending projections into different regions of the spinal cord. So you could see of course, these projections are also organized relative to one another. So basically, what emerges from this is that you can predict the identity of a target of a neuron based on the location of the cell body of a given neuron in the nervous system. So this is obvious at many levels of organization of the nervous system. So if you take a slice, for example, through the cortex, there are different layers of the cortex, as illustrated here by Santiago Ramon y Cajal. And what you see here, what you realize when you start mapping the connections of these neurons, is that neurons that lie in this layer of the cortex, so layer 6, according to Cajal, tend to project their axons outside of the cortex. But neurons that sit in these first two top layers of the cortex will tend to project their axons within those layers. So again, you can use the position of a cell body of a neuron to predict where this neuron will project in the nervous system. So this is also evident in the motor system, in the spinal cord, and this is an old drawing from George Romanes, who mapped the position of motor neurons in the spinal cord of the cat. And so here what you see along this axis is the position of groups of motor neurons that innervate different muscles. And so basically, so this is an anterior of the spinal cord, this is a posterior end of the spinal cord, and what you see here is that motor neurons that innervate muscles that are proximal, such as the rectus femoris, lie within regions that are in the anterior part of the lumbar spinal cord. And neurons that innervate muscles that are more distal in the limb, such as the plantaris, lie in more posterior regions of the spinal cord. So again, there is this close relationship between the cell body position of a neuron and the identity of the target of this neuron. So in this case, it's a muscle, and it's a special case of topography, which is called myotopy. So that's the relationship between neuron soma position and muscle position. So I'm going to take you through the different levels of organization of motor neurons, and I just want to illustrate where these motor neurons lie, and I'm going to be showing a lot of pictures that are sort of like this, which is a cross-section through a developing embryo. So this is the head, that's the tail, and here's the limb bud. So it's this cross-section here. This is the spinal cord. This is the dorsal root ganglion. That's the limb bud, and you can see that there are nerves coming out to innervate various muscles in the limb. So if you look through the different levels of the spinal cord, and if you also look at the targets of the different motor neurons, what you distinguish is at the columnar level, there are motor neurons that innervate limb muscles that lie within something that is called the LMC, the lateral motor column, and there are motor neurons that innervate axial muscles, which are muscles of the body, so back or in the belly somewhere. And these are called the medial motor column. And if you now look in the spinal cord, so this is one half of the spinal cord, a cross-section, what you can see is that the cell body position of these neurons is distinct, and it's conserved at many different levels if you go from anterior to the posterior in the spinal cord. So limb-innervating motor neurons are divided into LMCL and LMCM motor neurons. So those in the lateral LMC innervate dorsal limb muscles, and those in the medial LMC innervate ventral limb muscles. And these are further subdivided into motor pools, where a motor neuron that belongs to a specific pool, or motor neurons that belong to a specific pool, innervate one particular muscle. So again, there is a stereotypic position of each one of those pools within the ventral spinal cord. So my lab has been focusing on the intermediate level of complexity in the system, and that's the level of division, and I hope you appreciate that this is a binary system. So you have two different groups of motor neurons that occupy two different positions in the spinal cord, two different targets, so ventral muscles and dorsal limb muscles, and by consequence, you have two different axonal trajectories, the dorsal nerves and then the ventral nerves. So in the context of the system, I will tell you about my experiments and my lab's experiments that try to elucidate the formation, the emergence of myotopy in these motor neurons. So obviously, myotopy emerges at the level of axonal projections. So these axons that exit the spinal cord, enter the limb, project dorsally or ventrally, and also at the level of cell body position. So motor neurons are born in the ventricular zone. They migrate, and at this time, they tend to be all jumbled up, but over time, the LMCL motor neurons tend to be positioned more laterally, LMCM motor neurons tend to be positioned more medially. And these two are happening more or less at the same time. So first I will tell you about axonal projections. So this is just a slide to get you back to the basics of neural development. Of course, axonal guidance is all about growth cone guidance. So growth cones are structures illustrated here by Ramon y Cajal, which are at the growing end of the axon. So this is basically the same neuron, and you can see that it's growing this axon. And at the end, there is a tip, which is actually called a growth cone and was discovered by Dr. Santiago y Cajal. And this tip will eventually end up at some muscle or target neuron. It will form a synapse. So axon guidance is all about the growth cone, and it's all about what the growth cone does and how it feels, how it senses external guidance cues, which tend to be proteins secreted by the periphery. So in the system of these lateral motor column neurons, motor neurons, for a long time it's been known that there are specific events that lead to the innervation of muscles. So this is the work of Lynn Landmesser, Cynthia Lanz-Jones, Catherine Tozzini, and of course Victor Hamburger. And what these people have shown through a series of very nice cellular experiments is that the motor neurons, which are located here, send axons through the ventral root, which get to the base of the limb. And there, they invariably choose the dorsal or the ventral limb nerve. So this happens without or with very, very few errors. So the green axons know to go up and the red axons know to go down. And there was a series of very elegant surgical manipulations where the limb was rotated before the axons were able to enter the limb. And what was discovered was that actually that this rotation of the limb can influence the trajectory of the axon of the axons, and also implying that there are molecular cues that are deposited right here at this convergence or divergence point that tell the axons which way to go. So the molecular identity of these axon guidance cues have started to be unraveled with the identification of transcription factors expressed in motor neurons, but also in the limb. So what I'm showing you here is islet 1 and limb 1, which are members of the limb homeodomain transcription factor family, which have been identified to be expressed in these two populations of motor neurons in the Jessel lab and in the Cliff Tabin's lab at Harvard. LMX1B was discovered to be expressed only in the dorsal half of the limb, and its expression sort of abuts very nicely, the proximal distal dorsal ventral boundary abuts very nicely this point of divergence of the green and the red axons. And some of my work as a postdoc has shown that you need LMX1B and you need LIM1 for this decision of green and red axons to occur normally. So if you knock out LMX1B, the green and the red axons enter dorsal and ventral limb with more or less random incidence. So my work has also my work and actually work of other people have shown that members of the efferin A ligand and EPHA tyrosine kinase receptor family are basically the effectors of this choice of dorsal trajectory. So efferin A, which are the repulsive ligands, are efferin A, so in particular efferin A5 and efferin A2, are expressed in this ventral domain in a limb. EPHA4 is highly enriched on the green motor neurons and also on their axons and their growth cones. And basically when they get to the base of the limb, they are repulsed from this ventral ligand, from the ventral efferin A, and they project into the dorsal limb. And by the way, the axons always enter the limb as a fascicle because it is the limb mesenchyme that is sort of constraining them into two channels. So you have the choice of only going dorsally or ventrally. So it's a really, really nice system to work out what are the molecular cues affecting this very simple decision. So recently we have shown that there is a very nice, if you will, a molecular symmetry in the system. So for the red axons, it's the efferin Bs and the EPHBs that are important for this DV trajectory choice. So efferin B2, which is a ligand from a related family of efferins, is expressed in the dorsal half of the limb, exactly, again, right near this choice point. EPHB1 is highly enriched in LMCM neurons and also on their axons. And again, when the EPHB1 expressing red axons are coming to the base of the limb, they see that there is efferin B2 present dorsally, and they choose to grow into the ventral limb. So this happens through kind of a repulsive mechanism that has been well documented for EPHs and efferins. So what is also interesting is that there are transcription factors, the transcription factors that I told you about a few slides ago, islet 1, LIM1, and LMX1B, actually control the expression of EPHA4, EPHB1, and the two efferin families in the limb. So this has been shown through some of my work as a postdoc. So what is nice about this is that it actually brings together two separate parts of the field of axon guidance. So for a long time, people were identifying transcription factors or effectors of these transcription factors, but the two have never been linked or very, very rarely linked. So this was one of the first few examples of linking the two sides of the axon guidance field. So this might look like a sort of a complete model of what is going on, how these green and red axons might be guided. But actually it's not, because we know this from genetic studies. So if you get rid of EPHA4 or EPHB1 in a mouse, The defects are not always 100% penetrant, suggesting that there are other cues that are guiding these red and green axons at the base of the limb. So we took advantage of the fact that in LMX1B mutants, the phenotypes are almost always 100% penetrant, implying that this molecule is controlling maybe other ligands than ephrin Bs and ephrin As. So Diana Krawczyk, a postdoc in the lab, carried out a screen for proteins that are expressed in the limb, for genes that are expressed in the limb, that are under the control of LMX1B. And she took limb mesenchyme from LMX1B mutants and compared them to wild type using Affymetrix microarrays. And to make the long story short, she discovered that netrin-1 is highly enriched in the dorsal limb. So its expression follows very much that of LMX1B. And in netrin-1 LAG-Z knock-in mice, you can see that beta-gal, which is supposed to be a surrogate marker for netrin-1 expression, is highly enriched in the dorsal limb, right next to this choice of dorsal or ventral trajectory that the LMCL and LMCM axons are making. So what is really cool about netrin-1 is that it's a bifunctional axon guidance molecule. And this has been known for a long time through many studies from Marc Tissot-Davin, Joe Collodi, and Muming Pu. So what these people have shown, people in their labs, have shown is that netrin can bind two different kinds of receptors. So it can bind DCC homodimers to elicit attraction towards netrin, or it can bind a DCC ONC5 heterodimer to elicit repulsion. And this is illustrated here through an experiment in which Xenopus growth cones from the spinal cord are exposed to netrin. You can see that over time, so this is a single growth cone, this growth cone is attracted towards netrin. But if you overexpress ONC5C in such growth cones, you see that now they're repulsed and they grow away from netrin. So when we looked at the expression of receptors for netrin in LMC motor neurons, we found something very interesting. So we're right here, right, looking at the expression of different genes in motor neurons. So we're only looking at one half of the spinal cord close to the ventral root. What we saw was that neogenin-1 and DCC are more or less expressed in all LMC neurons, and these are marked by islet-1 and limb-1. But when we looked at the expression of repulsive receptors, such as ONC5C, what we saw was that ONC5C is highly enriched in the population that is expressing islet-1. So this is illustrated a little bit better here through some Photoshop magic, where basically we take adjacent sections stained for LIM-1, ILET-1, ONC5C, and we superimpose them, and you see a lot of yellow here saying that ONC5C is expressed in the ILET-1 population. So this is the population that grows towards, that projects their axons towards the ventral limb. So this suggested a very simple model, and that was that the attractive receptors are expressed in all LMC neurons. The repulsive receptors, such as ONC5C, are only expressed in LMCM neurons, the red neurons that project to the ventral limb. Netrin-1 is expressed in the dorsal limb. So the green axons expressing only the attractive receptors are attracted towards netrin. The red axons are repulsed from netrin and they grow into the ventral limb. So that was a model, and then we tested it in many different ways. And I'm not going to show you all the experiments, obviously, because of time constraints, but I will tell you about one way that we were testing this model using genetics. So this is looking in different knockout mice, of course, with genes encoding proteins in the netrin signaling pathway knocked out. So to do this, we used a very nice tool that was derived in Hitoshi Okamoto's lab at Rikan in Japan. And this is a transgene which marks only one of the two populations of LMC motor neurons. It's basically an islet-1 enhancer hooked up to an alkaline phosphatase reporter. And here these two show motor neurons and axons in the limb. And what you can see here is that you have very nice alkaline phosphatase expression in the ventral root. There is no alkaline phosphatase in sensory neurons. And then if you look at the limb in the periphery, what you can see is that alkaline phosphatase is marking very nicely only axons in the ventral limb nerve. There are no alkaline phosphatase axons here. So we crossed this transgene to various mutants in the netrin signaling pathway. And what we discovered was that, well, first of all, let me tell you about the technique that was used to quantify these. So basically, these are exactly the same section. One is stained for a neurofilament using an antibody, and one is stained for alkaline phosphatase using an enzymatic reaction. And basically, what Diana did was compile all the sections from a given embryo and measure how many axons were found, how many alkaline phosphatase positive axons were found in the ventral limb nerve versus dorsal limb nerve. So in wild type, basically pretty much all of the alkaline phosphatase is found in the ventral limb nerve, so as predicted. So LMCM axons project ventrally. But in the NETRIN-1 knockout, what we started to see is that there are some axons that are growing into the dorsal limb nerve, some LMCM axons. And this can be quantified here and is statistically significant. And really, more interestingly, in UNC5C mutants, now you see many, many axons projecting into the dorsal limb when compared to just the straight, the NETRIN-1 hypomorph. And so, again, that is highly significant and basically says that, first of all, you need NETRIN-1 for the fidelity of LMC axon projections, and second, you need UNC5C. But what was really striking is that the DCC knockout has no phenotype, basically. So you have as many axons projecting ventrally as you do in wild-type embryos. And that was really striking because for a long time it's been postulated that for repulsion from NETRIN to occur, you would need DCC, the attractive receptor. And that is sort of what you will get if you read any developmental biology textbook. But now it seems to be less true with these experiments. So we're pretty excited about these results. So, of course, there's also neogenin that remains in these neurons, which is an alternative receptor for NETRIN-1. And now we're doing the DCC neogenin double cross, and I only have some preliminary results, but it looks like, again, in DCC neogenin double mutants, you don't have a phenotype. So it seems that in vertebrates, you don't need the attractive receptors for NETRIN for repulsion to occur. So we also wanted to answer the question of whether NETRIN is directing LMC axons directly, if you will. So if you think about this, the genetic experiments suggest that these genes, UNC5C, NETRIN, are important for guidance of LMC axons, but they don't really prove that NETRIN itself is capable of binding LMC, of guiding LMC axons. So one way to answer this question was to take the system in vitro and take advantage of a very nice STRIPE assay that was developed in Bonhoeffer lab. So basically this involves just taking cover slips, coating them with stripes of protein A or protein B, then taking an explant from the spinal cord right here and putting these explants right here and challenging motor neurons to grow their axons on these different stripes. And of course, you could imagine a situation where the axons prefer protein B to grow on, and so then you see axons only growing on protein B stripes, and rarely you might see them growing on protein A stripes. So Sujan Kao, a postdoc in my lab, has adapted the system to be used with motor neurons. And I apologize for the contrast in these panels here. But basically, he's taken lateral LMC neurons, so the green neurons that normally project towards NETRIN, towards the dorsal limb, and he's taken the medial LMC neurons, which project away from NETRIN into the ventral limb, and he's cultured them on stripes of NETRIN. So what you see in light in gray here are actually stripes of NETRIN, and this is shown in these micrographs, but they didn't come through very well because of contrast. And so in green are the axons, and here in blue are basically cumulative results of many such explants being challenged. And what you see here is that normally, lateral LMC axons don't show a preference for FC or FC stripe. They sort of grow everywhere. But then if they're given a choice between FC protein or NETRIN, they prefer to grow on NETRIN, which is in stark contrast to medial LMC axons, which prefer to grow away from NETRIN. So here, these are the stripes of NETRIN. You can see that most axons pile up in the FC lanes. And this can be quantified compared to the FC-FC controls, and is significant in both experiments. So that says, I think, that NETRIN is a bifunctional axon guidance molecule for LMC neurons. And I think that's a really, really exciting finding, at least for us. So what is emerging is that the system is composed of sort of two parallel axon guidance pathways. So on one hand, you have axons, green and red axons, being guided by efferents in the limb, so efferin B in the dorsal limb, efferin A in the ventral limb, guiding EPH-A or EPH-B expressing green and red axons. But at the same time, these axons also express receptors for netrin, attractive receptors or repulsive receptors, and they these receptors mediate response to netrin. And what's really interesting is actually that the same transcription factors that control EPH-A4 expression, for example, also control the expression of these netrin receptors. But I think what is even more interesting is that this allows us to now test, I think, a very interesting question that still remains in axon guidance, and that is, how can a growth cone integrate different axon guidance cues? So, as you know from reading many of the big journals, for a long time, people have been identifying different axon guidance cues, such as netrins, efferents, etc., and people have been showing that there are phenotypes in mice that have these different ligands or receptors knocked out. But what is still missing, I think, is a demonstration in vivo of how a growth cone is able to integrate signals from attractive cues and repulsive cues, or if you want, even maybe two attractive cues. So some experiments have been done in vitro, but that is still unknown. So the effects the mode of integration in vivo is still very much understudied. So we are thinking about very simple two extreme models in the case of the motor neuron axon growth cone. One of them is that you have the receptors for the green cue and the red cue sort of separate, and these activate separate pathways in response to the presence of the ligand. And that impinges on the cytoskeleton, whose rearrangement leads to growth cone turning, right? So you get more stability of the growth cone here, you get some more collapse right here, and that's how you get turning. Well, that's been known for a really long time. In the extreme case, we could imagine that these two receptors function as a complex, and when the growth cone can see the two cues being present, it activates maybe a slightly different signaling cascade that leads to the cytoskeleton rearrangement. So obviously, to resolve the difference between these two models, one has to identify what are the different signaling components that are important actually in vivo. So there have been a lot of studies that have identified many, many different signaling intermediates in vitro through biochemical studies. And you know, as you can see from these slides, the EPH receptors have many effectors intracellularly. So do the netrin receptors. But which one of these are actually relevant in vivo, I think, still remains a big question. So that's one thing that we're trying to address, and I will just show you one example of this, looking at Src family kinases, which have been actually implicated in both EPH signaling and attractive netrin signaling. So Tsujin Kao, a postdoc in the lab, took advantage of the similarities between mouse and chick to address the question of whether Src family kinase signaling is important for LMC axon guidance. So first he looked at the expression of Src family kinase members, and he found that Src, Fin, and CSK expressed in LMC neurons. So other members of the Src family kinase family are not. And CSK is actually a very interesting protein. It's a regulator of function of Src family kinases. So when it phosphorylates SFKs, it actually blocks their function. So Tsujin also took advantage of the awesome power of chick electroporation, which to me is sort of like a poor man's genetics. So if you can't afford to make the mouse, or if you can't get it from some collaborator who's not willing to collaborate, then you turn to the chicken. So it's a very simple technique. You basically inject a plasmid, expression plasmid, or actually siRNAs, into the lumen of the neural tube. You apply current, this translocates the DNA to one side, and then you end up with embryos that look like this, so you can sort of make out the limb right here, and this is the spinal cord that's expressing GFP. You can section it, and you can see that it's only expressed on one side, and you can actually see axons coming out of the spinal cord growing towards the limb. So then what you can do is you can take many sections through a given embryo and count the number of GFP axons that are present in the dorsal limb nerve versus ventral limb nerve. and to give you this kind of distribution of GFP fluorescence. So normally, if you take a wild-type embryo electroporated with GFP, you just see sort of more or less random distribution, which reflects the proportions of LMCL and LMCM motor neuron populations within the spinal cord. So this is illustrated here. Well, actually, it's a slightly different experiment. So in this experiment, Tsujin overexpresses CSK, which blocks Src family kinases. And so this is just one section, of course, and this is the integration over many embryos and many sections, stained for neurofilament and GFP. So in this case, there is no CSK that has been electroporated. Tsujin is using the enhancer of islet-1 hooked up to a GFP promoter as a marker of these LMCM axons that project to the ventral limb nerve. And you can see that this is highly specific. But when he now electroporates CSK together with this construct, what you see is that there is more or less a random distribution of these axons, arguing that you need Src family kinase signaling for the fidelity of LMC axon trajectory choice. So, of course, we went beyond this, and I'm not going to show you all the experiments that further this idea, but one key experiment was to, of course, look in the knockout. I'm not going to take you through all the panels, but basically Tsujin looked in the Src knockout mice at the same stage, and I think he found something interesting and maybe a little bit unexpected, and that was that there was no effect on outgrowth of axons, and there was a lot of evidence, actually, from past studies that you needed Src family kinase signaling or Src signaling to promote outgrowth. But again, all these experiments have been done in vitro, and nobody's looked in the knockout. So we didn't see any effects on outgrowth, which was great, but we also saw that there were effects on fidelity of projection. So basically, you started to see errors of red axon projections and green axon projections. And this number here, actually, I don't want to get into the details of the axon guidance math, but what it says is that the red axons now choose the dorsal or the ventral trajectory with equal proportion. So their projections are randomized, and that means that you need Src family kinase or Src itself for LMC axon guidance. So what we want to do is, of course, extend these studies to many of the other molecules, and that you can see that it's maybe a little bit difficult. We're not going to go through every single knockout mouse, but we're starting with some interesting candidates which actually might differentiate between the red and the green signaling pathway. So we have some recent evidence that shows that alpha chimerin mutants, which have been implicated in EPH signaling but not netrin signaling, have also specific defects in the selection of the DV trajectory. So, but for the other, for analyzing the function of other signaling intermediates, we plan to use pharmacology and maybe some in vitro experiments to show that these are relevant for LMC axon guidance. But of course, we try to stay in vivo as much as possible. So in the remaining time, I want to show you some of our experiments on the identity, or trying to address the identity of molecular factors controlling the cell body position of motor neurons. So what is known is, of course, motor neurons are born in the ventricular zone. So this is the ventricular zone here. That's the midline of the spinal cord. The other half would be here. The ventral root is here, and that's through this root that the axons grow to reach their targets in the limb. So normally, at early stages, you generate the LMCM motor neurons, the red motor neurons, and then what happens is that as a second wave of neurogenesis, you generate the LMCL motor neurons, which then move through the red neurons. So you see this sort of intermediate stage where the two populations are intermingled, and then eventually the LMCL motor neurons end up on the lateral side. And so one trivial explanation for this is obviously that you have a switching of expression of whatever markers we're using here, but I can tell you that this is not the case. So we've looked at genetic labeling of these populations, and it's pretty stable, the expression of these markers. What we also know is that the transcription factors that control the axon guidance projections, such as LIM1, islet1, and FOXP1, I didn't show you the data for this, are also controlling or influencing the position of these motor neurons. So if you overexpress LIM1, you can get more neurons to take up this lateral position. If you overexpress islet1 in the chick, you can get more motor neurons to take up this more medial position. So that's suggested a very simple model, and believe me, I like simple models. because then they lead to very simple experiments, and I think that's what science should be about. So our simple model was that FOXP1, LIM1, and ILET1 influence the reception of some kind of a guidance signal, and this is now related to, of course, guidance of cell bodies as they're migrating, so that there is a signal that's present in the ventral spinal cord. It acts on this reception system. It could be the receptor itself, it could be some signaling component that are controlled by these transcription factors. So the big question for a while was, what is the identity of this ligand receptor pair? And that question didn't remain unsolved for a very long time, because there was a very, very good candidate for this ligand receptor pair, and that is reelin and its receptor. So reelin is a large extracellular matrix protein that is secreted by some of the overlying neurons in the cortex, for example. It acts on two different kinds of receptors, VLDL receptor or APOER2 receptor. The evidence for these two receptors is actually pretty thin right now. DAB1 is a very important signaling intermediate which basically gets phosphorylated by Src family kinase in response to binding of reelin to these receptors. And then this protein somehow conveys the signal further downstream, impinges on the cytoskeleton that leads to specific migration behavior changes. So that's pretty well studied for reelin. There are also important reelin mutations in humans and, of course, in mice as well, and they lead to abnormalities in the cerebellar development, but also in layering of the cortex. So this is some classic work from a few years ago. So we thought to look at reelin expression in the spinal cord and also look at its receptor expression, and that's been shown before by other people at different levels of the spinal cord, so we're sort of confirming their studies. But I just want to show you here. It's a busy slide, but the point is that reelin is there in the spinal cord. It's schematized here in blue at early stages of development and also at later stages of development, close to where these LMC motor neurons lie. The receptors are there, VLDL receptor, early stages, later stages. This is true both in mouse and in chick. I'm not showing you the chick data. But what's interesting is that DAB1, which is a signaling intermediate in the reelin signaling pathway, we think is expressed at two different levels in LMC motor neurons, at both early and late stages of migration. So this is summarized here, and perhaps the only actually region that you can see is the region of high DAB1 expression, which coincides with the LMCL population. So this is the green population right here. LMCM motor neurons express much lower levels of DAB1. And this is actually quantified here, both at the level of mRNA and at the level of protein. And we did this experiment both in mouse and in chick. So there's basically roughly twice as much DAB1 in the green population as in the red population. So what we think might be going on, and again, it's a simple model, is that reelin is present in the ventral spinal cord, and it can only affect LMCL motor neurons because those express much higher level of DAB1 than LMCM. And then that obviously has some kind of an impact on actin cytoskeleton, and it results in the displacement of LMCL motor neurons to the lateral side of the spinal cord. So one prediction would be that if you were to get rid of DAB1 or reelin, the green motor neurons will behave exactly as the red motor neurons, or in the converse case, gain of function of DAB1 in LMCM neurons might now lead them to behave like the green motor neurons, so move laterally. And so I'm not going to show you the data for all of these experiments. I'll show you the most important data, I think, which is the mutant phenotype in the mouse. So what we see is that, first of all, there's no change in identity of motor neurons, and I'm not going to drag you through all the bars in these graphs. But most importantly, there is a change in position of motor neurons, both in DAB1 mutants and in reelin mutants. So the most important panel is this one, which is a cumulative position of motor neurons in multiple slides, multiple sections in multiple embryos. And what you see here is this classic position of LMCL neurons and LMCM neurons, lateral and medial. And in DAB1, the position now is shifted, suggesting or arguing that DAB1 is required for the specification of position. If you overexpress DAB1, you actually turn this sort of around, system around, and the red motor neurons now start to be positioned more laterally. What's interesting is that in the mutants, the position defects are actually very long-lasting, and they have profound effects on the position of different motor pools. So these are the groups of motor neurons that innervate one specific muscle. Whoops. Am I out of time? Sorry, I pressed something wrong. Yeah. Great. So P3 positive motor neurons that innervate a particular muscle in a limb, you can see that in the wild type they have this characteristic position, and in DUB1 knockout they're much more spread out. This is reproducible, seen in many embryos. So in summary, the phenotypes that we're seeing is that there is a disruption in cell body position. It's subtle, yes, but we might think that it's significant. In contrast to the trajectory of axons, and I didn't show you the data for this, but basically the axons remain unchanged. So their trajectories are dorsal or ventral, just as in wild-type embryos. So what this means is that you can actually disrupt, or you can uncouple the position of cell bodies from the position of axon trajectory. So by getting rid of reelin or DAB1, you uncouple the two sides of the system, which is something interesting to think about. So one last series of experiments had to do with the relationship between cell body position and axonal trajectory. So if you think about it, there are these transcription factors that control the receptor, the receptors for netrons and efferents on axons that give you this DV choice. So wouldn't it be really interesting if the same transcription factors controlled also the effectors of cell body position? And so you could imagine some experiments in which, for example, if you change FOXP1 expression, you might affect the expression of DAB1. Or if you were to get rid of LIM1, you might actually decrease the expression of DAB1. So these experiments were done in collaboration with Ben Novich's lab at UCLA. And what we saw with Ben was that, and his student David, of course, what we saw was that in experiments, in mouse embryos where we overexpress FOXP1 in regions of the spinal cord where FOXP1 is normally not expressed, what we see is that there is an upregulation of DAB1. And this is converse to what we see in FOXP1 mutants. So in regions of the spinal cord where DAB1 is normally highly expressed in LMCL neurons, it disappears in the FOXP1 mutants. And, of course, this is quantifiable. And it says that FOXP1 is required for DAB1 expression in LMC motor neurons. So next came the question of what makes the difference of DAB1 expression in DAB1 expression between LMCL and LMCM neurons. So obviously, FOXP1 is expressed in all of these blue motor neurons, so it's probably not the thing that controls DAB1 expression differentially. So we thought about a different model, and that would be that islet1, which is highly enriched in LMCM neurons, might be actually suppressing DAB1, so acting in concert with FOXP1 to suppress DAB1 expression to give you DAB1 low levels, to give you medial position of motor neurons. In contrast, we thought that LIM1 or LHX1 might actually drive up the levels of expression of DAB1 in addition to FOXP1. And then we know from chick experiments that if you overexpress DAB1, it gives you a lateral position. So that's a very simple way of looking at things. And we tested this by looking in LIM1 knockout. And what we saw there was that, again, this is a very complicated slide. So first of all, you lose, we had to use a conditional allele of LIM1, so LIM1 TALAG Z over FLOX, close to islet1 Cre, which basically expresses Cre in all motor neurons. What we saw was, first of all, that the position of motor neurons that normally would express LIM1 was changed, and that is illustrated better here. Basically, the blue circles is the position of motor neurons that are LMCL neurons but lost their expression of LIM1. So in wild type, you find a few of these, very small proportion, but when you get rid of LIM1, what you see is that actually there are many, many more of them. And second is that now some of them start to be positioned aberrantly. So this is on the other side of this dotted line, which represents sort of the L versus M boundary. So you need LIM1 to specify LMCL position. Second, we looked at the expression of DAB1 in these animals. And very happily, we saw that DAB1 mRNA, as shown here, I think this is mRNA, yes, it is severely decreased in this conditional knockout of LIM1 when compared to controls. So that says, and this is both at protein level and mRNA level, so that says that you need LIM1 to drive up DAB1 expression in this LMCL population of motor neurons. So what does it really all mean, you know, sort of a big picture? So we think that we have a very simple model of how myotopy or organization in the nervous system might be controlled. So we have transcription factors within the motor neurons themselves that control the expression of receptors of axon guidance, which respond to ligands whose expression is controlled by transcription factors in a limb. So this interaction gives you a choice of axonal trajectory, but also the same transcription factors that control these also control or gate Wieland signaling. And that gives you a specification of medial versus lateral position. So in this way, one might think that neurons are coordinating the axonal trajectory with the position of their soma within the nervous system. So I'll leave you with one last big question, which we're trying to address now, and that is, what is the function of myotopy? So, of course, Penfield demonstrated this very nice organization in the motor cortex and the sensory cortex. These are examples from, there are examples of this in many regions of the nervous system, but what is the point of this? So what we're trying to do is trying to answer the question of whether the position of soma in the nervous system matters. So in the context of these motor neurons, one way to think about this is in the context of sensory motor connectivity. So sensory neurons send their projections down into the spinal cord to synapse onto motor neuron dendrites. And one simple circuit is the monosynaptic stretch reflex, which is known as the knee jerk reflex. So you could imagine that if you disrupt the position of these motor neurons, first you might disrupt their dendritic arbors. Second, you might also disrupt how the sensory neurons connect to these arbors. So we're addressing these questions now together with Ben, looking in the DAB1 conditional mice and using electrophysiology to look at the connectivity at this level. Now, another way to think about this is in the context of electrical coupling of motor neurons. So motor neurons, for a period during development, are coupled electrically through gap junctions. And people think that this is very important for their maturation as part of motor circuits that will activate the movement of specific contraction of specific muscles in response to specific interneurons. So they need to be electrically coupled for a while during development. So obviously, if they're mispositioned, if the motor neurons that belong to a specific pool are mispositioned, that might have an effect, again, on the maturation of motor circuitry. So we're also going to address that question using electrophysiology. So I will thank the people that were involved in this project, Tsujin, of course, Elena, who did all the Wieland DAB1 experiments except for the FOXP1 stuff, Wendy, I didn't have time to talk about her work, she's a student in the lab, and also I would like to thank my collaborators and people who have contributed reagents, Julie and Meirong, two very hardworking technicians, and my funding agencies, and thank you for listening.
Thanks, Arthur. That was great. One question I've always wondered about when we have these growth factors that I guess must be diffusing from the source to where they exert their activity, how do they get in between the cells and so on? Or are they expressed only kind of at the outer edge next to the cells that they have to kind of deflect away? Anyhow, you see.
It's a really good question. So in the context of this dorsal-ventral trajectory choice, actually the molecules that we have identified, netrin and efferents, are not diffusing very far from the cells that are expressing them. In fact, the efferents are fixed, attached to the cell membrane. So the efferent A's are attached through a GPI anchor and the efferent B's have a transmembrane domain. And netrin, of course, in the spinal cord is diffusing you know, some distance away, and people have shown this, I think, now finally conclusively using antibodies. But in the limb, we have evidence that it doesn't really diffuse very far, so we're using, again, antibodies, and it's not diffusing very far from the cells that are expressing it, expressing Netrin. And I think we think that, you know, it's able to interact with the extracellular matrix. There are some laminin homology domains in Netrin, so I think because of these, maybe it's not diffusing very far in some contexts.
Thank you.
Thank you.